Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. As I record this in early May of 2025, I am just soaking up the warm but not too warm days, and so is my cat. How are you? Are you up early enough to hear the morning chorus? You know, the spring songs of all the birds? For this person, it's good medicine. Speaking of medicine, did you know that this week we celebrate nurses? Well, more about that in the second half of our show. First, though, our Desert Oracle Radio episode today was produced by Ken Lane, May 7th, 2021. Ken explores our history of telling and hearing stories from prehistoric campfires to the present, and also how those things affect us. I will never think of live theater the same after this one. Here is Medicine Show.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. The time of night when we gather round our radios for story time. We have always been suckers for story time. That's about the only historical fact disputed by no one at all. It is the greatest theater, the mystery of the darkness, the flicker and crackle of a fire, the distant sounds of the breeze and the night birds. In the round, as they say in show business. In the song and dance trade. I think the way they shut down live performance around the world for a year straight did the most psychic damage to us, for adults at least. The billion or so kids who got a year plus sensory deprivation sentence are forever changed in ways we will not begin to understand until the end of this decade. When the Hydra head comes all the way up. For all of us, though, to not even have the option of seeing a public performance, a honky-tonk band, live theater, a monster movie down at the multiplex, a baseball game, a drunken wedding, a Sunday sermon. Well, that was something that gnawed all year long at our very humanity. Great changes were already in the works, and we have been all too willing volunteers for these global-scale experiments in turning us all into pod people. Destroying our remaining neighborhood businesses to the direct and immediate financial benefit of a dozen or so technology companies that have just managed to take a much bigger bite out of our lives, trying to keep us shut off from the world around us. Prescribe just enough pills and yoga and stimulus checks and augmented reality video game therapy to keep us all from cracking up completely. But right on the verge. theama. That's ancient Greek for both a vision and a spectacle. Six of one, half dozen of the other. From theama, we get theater. Originally in the round, around the fire. Where the storyteller was also a comedian, a mystic, a mimic, and more than anything, a doctor. Because life is hard and it always wants your attention. Now, a shaman may or may not do some hands-on healing as part of this communal ritual, like Jesus did in the public squares, or in the natural theater of a fishing boat as stage with the multitudes gathered around the lake shore. Sometimes these rituals took place in a cave that provided the dark and the quiet required for the ceremonies, the initiation, the mysteries. The sacred mysteries of old Greece were like this. People were not consumers there to be entertained, but members of the congregation, following an ancient script, sharing the sacred drink that made the beautiful old rituals come alive in their hearts. All were healed, not least the priests, the performers, the entertainers themselves, the sickest of them all. Playwrights, actors, outcasts, jugglers, musicians, dancers, visionaries, the weird and the damned. Today, if you're a little weird, they put you on a pharmaceutical diet before you're out of short pants. No matter, the weird will always break out somewhere along the way. The weird will find a way. But when your society is sick and your healing rituals are gone, and you have no system for integrating the oddballs, well, maybe some of your oddballs will find their way to the stage or the pulpit. And maybe some of them become serial killers or politicians or hedge fund managers. In olden days, early in our species and reaching back to the Neanderthals and our other various cousins, each little group of people had a shaman, the one who was a little bit or a lot off from the beginning. Maybe they were creepy, or they had visions, or prophecies, or they did not look like everybody else, or they were always making puppets out of animal heads. That kid's not right, somebody might say. And then the not right would apprentice to the shaman, the field doctor, the clown in chief. Everybody was part of the ritual. That's what makes it different than a non-ritual performance. You come to take part, to be healed. If you ever come across a 1985 book by Rogan Taylor called The Death and Resurrection Show, well, grab that thing up because it's a rarely seen treasure. And in this book, the whole development of entertainment from the fire ring rituals of our very distant ancestors to the stadium rituals of rock and roll, it's all in there. And plenty of modern performances can transcend entertainment and become transformative ritual for various specialized populations. Even within the agnostic framework of casino ballrooms and summer music festivals. Rock stars and famous preachers both leave people screaming and moaning and falling faint. In the 2016 book Tune In, John Lennon is amazed to find children in wheelchairs always lined up at the dressing room doors at the height of Beatlemania. Each child was there to be touched, to be healed. John Lennon wanted to make good records and not have to work a day job. But the Beatlemaniacs needed him to be a healer, a messiah. And in the 1970s and the 1980s, every city in America had a midnight showing of a campy movie version of a 1973 glam rock musical play called The Rocky Horror Show. And it turned into the longest running movie in history because people turned it into their weekly religious ritual, a full audience participation movie projected on a screen taken over by dozens of people in costume and the rest serving as Greek chorus and throwers of various food items when called for, which was often. It's a rare example of the most proscenium of one-way entertainment stagings. The movie, projected on a rectangular screen framed by theatrical curtains, being ritually rushed by the audience who refused to just sit there and consume the entertainment. They must take part communally. And like the Greek mysteries, newcomers were initiates, virgins, required to endure a memorable hazing to join the cult. The way Richard O'Brien and Jim Sherman conceived and produced the London play was in the round. From 1973 to 1979, the Rocky Horror Show was performed in the round until it had to be restaged for its move to a proscenium theater. The usual psychic barrier between entertainer and audience was back. The metaphorical vertical plane of space in a theater, usually surrounded on the top and the sides by a physical proscenium arch, and on the bottom by the stage floor itself, which serves as the frame into which the audience observes from a more or less unified angle the events taking place upon the stage. Elvis Presley was another one expected to heal the sick at the height of his ministry. When Elvis made his post-Beatlemania return to television in 1968, he did it in the round. The small, rapt audience surrounding the king and his handful of musicians, just these people in rapture around a little stage surrounded by the darkness. And Elvis became a star again overnight, performing the ancient campfire magic. The TV tries, and so does TikTok and the virtual reality isolation goggles, but they do not heal the patient, not usually. Not unless the circumstances are just right. And then you might get some of it across. Set and setting, as Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert taught at Millbrook. That's why churches and temples and mosques have soaring ceilings and are places of ritual quiet and ritual prayer. Like a sacred grove, a sacred spring, or hilltop, the place is always chosen for cathedrals and megalithic structures. Once the state religions took over the duties of the shaman, once the last of the great mystery cults closed down, a new kind of ritual took form. Civilization created both mainstream and free agent entertainers. Mainstream theater, as in Athens, was meant to elevate the culture of the state. The themes were mythological, mostly. As in Roman theater, centuries later, where lines of players wearing their persona mask woodenly recited their lines. Meanwhile, outside on the streets, huge crowds followed the tumblers and the jugglers, the fire eaters and the snake charmers, violent puppet shows and lewd dances and magic. The people's culture, the natural home of the performers who did not meet the moral and social standards of the clergy. Here on the streets, the ancient magic had to be hidden, lest the religious authorities find out. The rituals of love and sex, death and dismemberment, healing and resurrection, it could all be done without the audience really being aware of the ancient ceremony they had joined. As commerce became our habit, freelance entertainers had to sell something. Their juggling skills, rope tricks, political satire, good and evil, death and resurrection, virtue and folly. After a real crowd pleaser, one of the players would take off their hat and pass it around. Hats for the sinners, shiny brass collection plates for the priests. In the market squares of the Mediterranean cities, the show people came calling with their covered wagon full of props and costumes. Generally a low-budget operation, some worn-out old horse pulling the crude wagon with the players' props and bedrolls inside, the players themselves mostly strolling alongside, avoiding highway robbers and crooked toll collectors. The main prop, the most important prop, was the Hellmouth. And the most economical way of presenting the Hellmouth with a traveling show was to put it in the back opening of the wagon, hidden until the crucial moment by the fabric flaps of the wagon's opening, the tent door, or a curtain hanging between posts or trees, what the Greeks called skini, meaning the curtain flaps on a tent door, then the structure of a wooden stage framed by curtains, and eventually our word scene, as in a theatrical scene or a movie scene. The New Testament, the best known and most read Greek book in the history of the world, uses the word skini dozens of times, usually referring to the tent tabernacles that armies used to carry around the homes of their various gods. The tent Hellmouth was the portal not just for magicians and demons, but for Yahweh, or for Zeus to commune with Alexander the Great. It was primal knowledge for audiences everywhere that the supernatural always crawled out of the Hellmouth. Jesus himself, in the medieval Passion plays, spends most of his time in hell, in ritual battle with the host of the underworld. The Hellmouth was the portal between worlds. In the most elaborate stagings, a burning ring of fire, from which the living and the dead, the mortals and the gods, travel back and forth to our world. In the 16th century, Shakespeare's time, the character most likely to be going into hell was Harlequin, the star of the era. A trickster, a buffoon, a magician who changed gender at will, both a healer and a devil. As Rogan Taylor writes in the Death and Resurrection show, Harlequin is the only character who escapes to hell. After whatever ridiculous scheme Harlequin once again gets away with, it's time to die and go to hell again. See you next time, suckers. Harlequin became the main character in Commedia dell'arte, the comedy theater style from Italy that swept Europe in the 16th century. Stock characters, endless situations and complications. Harlequin would often be the servant of some rich but stupid lord. Along with romantic comedy problems, there would be a doctor, a professor, a person of learning, an alchemist, a complete quack, a charlatan. And right behind them, at every feast day and county fair, the Hellmouth was waiting to accept the dead or vomit up some demons or make way for Harlequin's umpteenth return. We don't know much about props at Shakespeare's Globe Theater in the 1590s, but we know at least some of his productions featured an elaborate hell's mouth that took a large share of the production budget, made from a huge hogshead barrel ring. You need a backstage for this kind of work, even if your stage sticks out into the audience on three sides, like at the Globe. Or if your backstage is the inside of your covered wagon. When today's U.S. Southwest went from Mexico's military control to United States military control, the clowns and doctors became the medicine show. The Old West medicine show, with its aim to sell you some patent medicine, a cure-all, something to soothe what ails you. Then as now, the basic economics have to work out. Just enough people need to buy your stuff. The crowd enjoying the free show is, in fact, your free marketing for the snake oil, which was a real product for a while, along with a lot of real tribal remedies from flowers and tree bark. But mostly those favorites of cowboys and ladies of the evening everywhere. Morphine, cocaine, and alcohol. The most famous of the phony Indian cures was the Kickapoo Company, run by white men who sold millions of bottles of their various elixirs. The same sort of stuff you can buy in cute little brown medicine bottles today in Joshua Tree or Sedona or Santa Fe. Tinctures, essential oils, whatever they call it. A dose out of these little bottles is a shot of alcohol, more or less, with some added flavorings, which no longer include morphine, no more opium for the teething babies, and the cooks at the Chuck Wagon no longer keep a supply of cocaine for anybody who asks, because everything's illegal if you don't have a script from Dr. Nick. The medicine show could be a low-budget affair as it started in medieval Europe, when secular theater was banned in one country after another. Or it could be one of the 25 big shows that Kickapoo Medicine Company sent out to the Wild West mining towns and lumber camps. There's a street in Yucca Valley called Kickapoo, one of the geographically incorrect tribal names used in the 1950s town's first residential neighborhood. Probably came from Little Abner, where the Old West Kickapoo medicine was borrowed for moonshine, Kickapoo joy juice. Just like everything in Pioneer Town is named for phony Hollywood Western serials and not anything that ever happened in the actual place. Some of the medicine show brands have survived the transition to radio and television are Anacin, Bayer, Coca-Cola, Doan's Pills, 7-Up, and Geritol. The Kickapoo medicine shows developed the ancient market square show into a science. The doctor professor dressed in tuxedo and top hat with lots of jewelry to show off his success to the rubes. There would be an Indian shaman, too. Usually the real thing, not a showbiz entertainer by birth, working side by side with trick horsemen, gunfighters shooting blanks at each other, and a damsel in distress. A muscle man would gulp down some of the patent medicine and suddenly be able to do ever more fantastic feats of strength. And like the voodoo ceremonies tourists pay to see in New Orleans today, the rubes could enter a tent and see a real live ceremony. Minus the spiritual initiation, but still plenty powerful. Just please buy a pamphlet and a bottle of patent medicine on the way out. Thank you, friends. And if you think the idea of a strong man putting on an act to sell patent medicine to the rubes is ridiculous, that's exactly what people like Joe Rogan and Gwyneth Paltrow and Alex Jones do today. They're selling health and vitality, miracle cures. The performance is the primary part of the song and dance life. Do some tricks, make show, make it good, understand your role and what it means to society. But beyond the performance, there's the traveling life. Being on the road is the whole point. Like the musician Nick Cave wrote in one of the email newsletters he did to keep sane over the long global lockdown, I have come to the conclusion that I am essentially a thing that tours. There is a terrible yearning and a feeling of a life being half-lived. Well, we are coming out of our holes at long last. The concert and theater calendars are once again filling up with show dates. The movie theaters are meekly reopening. And by sometime this fall, the population of planet Earth will again have the Church of Public Performance open again. Along with the rituals of birth and life and death, funerals and parties, weddings and festivals, church summer camps where puberty blossoms. Around a campfire, the hypnotic flames do what the special effects of stage and screen cannot, no matter how fantastic. The campfire hypnotizes through the strange natural rhythms of fire and fuel, the darkness of a desert or forest or seaside night, the tall tales of the park ranger or class clown, the sing-alongs of old songs, old melodies from ancient times. Boy to Zyzix and across the great Mojave Wilderness. This is Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from Joshua Tree on Friday nights at 10 p.m. and heard on air around the United States on community radio stations. And on your podcast player in your pocket. And we are excited to do Desert Oracle performances again. I don't have any dates to announce yet, but we got a couple of things in progress. We're going to do some campfire stories. And we're going to do our nightclub stage show, which we last did at First World in Joshua Tree, right before the times changed. The soundscapes you heard on tonight's program are composed and performed by Joshua Tree's own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I believe Red, Blue, Black, Silver has a new record out. You can look him up on Bandcamp or Twitter or wherever. You know, I hate saying website names on this show. It just kind of dirties it. Speaking of this show, you can find out more about the program at desertoracle.com, and you can support our work by going to patreon.com/desertoracle. Thanks to all of you who help out keep the swamp cooler running out here. Enjoy what's left of the spring and get ready for the hot months. Thank you for listening, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Well, I do apologize for all the motor noises you might be hearing in the background, but it's kind of one of the sounds of spring in the Gallatin Valley. So anyway, there it is. And it's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM, and streaming at kgvm.org. Let's have some readings about our birds and seasons. Hello, bee. Here we go. From Nature, One Day at a Time by Kathy Katz. For May 4th, here's her reading. She says, except when mating, hummingbirds remain solitary. After a showy display to attract attention, males approach females, they mate, and then both return to a solitary life. After the brief mating encounter, females begin nest building, camouflaging the tiny moss-lined cup with plant down, fibers, and strands of spider silk. The female sits on the pea-sized eggs during incubation and stays with the nest only until the chicks can feed themselves. Hummingbirds are not monogamous, and a percentage are homosexual, both male and female. Several broods per season among hummingbirds are common. Females devote close to 2 weeks for incubation and about 3 weeks to feeding the chicks. So time is not as available for sex as it is for males. And then she closes with a quote from Bruce Benjamin in Biological Exuberance. And he writes, Anna's hummingbirds precisely orient the trajectory of their stunning aerial climbs and dives to face into the sun, thereby showing off their iridescent plumage to its best. As a male swoops toward the object of his attentions, either male or female, he resembles a brilliant glowing ember that grows in intensity as he gets closer. Wow. I have seen this phenomenon with our little calliope hummingbirds that like to nest and court out here by our house. I hope you've gotten to see such a thing. It is really amazing. For May 5th, Kathy writes, hummingbirds are known for their high energy activities. A human heart beats about 70 times per minute. Hummingbirds can beat at a steady 1,000 beats per minute. When they fly, they're flying. But when they sleep, they don't just sleep. They enter a state of torpor. Their heart rate slows to 36 beats per minute. After a comatose night, returning to their fast pace is not always possible, and many just don't survive the transition. Without a period of slow acclimation, they die. To expect deep sleepers to wake up fully alert is no less unreasonable than commanding a hummingbird to go from torpor to high-energy activity within a blink. Some humans need to recover from sleep and rarely experience the easy transition from sleep to wakefulness that chipper morning risers show. For many humans, when the connection between the importance of sleep recovery and their daily struggle is acknowledged, the problem is resolved. Allowing time for a gradual transition removes the stress. And then she closes with a quote from Claude Monet. And he said, I rise broken with fatigue each morning, but the coming of the dawn gives me courage. Our next little set of readings is from Daily Observations, Thoreau on the Days of the Year, edited by Steve Grant. On May 4th, 1857, Thoreau wrote, perhaps the most generally interesting event at present is a perfectly warm and pleasant day. It affects the greatest number, the well out of doors, and the sick in chambers. No wonder the weather is the universal theme of conversation. And for May 5th, 1846, he wrote, the subject of sex is a most remarkable one, since though it occupies the thoughts of all so much, and our lives and characters are so affected by the consequences which spring from this source, yet mankind, as it were, tacitly agrees to be silent about it. At least the sexes do, one to another. I think times have changed, Henry David Thoreau. What do you think? Next up, we've got some May 2025 skywatching tips from NASA. All month, Venus and Saturn are low in the eastern sky each morning, and you'll find bright Venus paired with much fainter Saturn. They start the month close together, but Saturn pulls away and rises higher over the course of the month. All month, the planets to look for on May evenings are Mars and Jupiter. They're visible for a couple hours after sunset in the western sky. And Corona Borealis. Practice finding this constellation in the eastern part of the sky during the first half of the night so you have a point of comparison when the TCRB Nova appears there, likely in the next few months. Astronomers have been waiting expectantly for light from a distant explosion to reach us here on Earth. An event called a nova is anticipated to occur sometime in the coming months. Some 3,000 light years away is a binary star system called T Coronae Borealis, or TCRB. It consists of a red giant star with a smaller white dwarf star orbiting closely around it. Now the giant's outer atmosphere is all puffed up, and the dwarf star is close enough that its gravity continually captures some of the giant's hydrogen. About every 80 years, the white dwarf has accumulated so much of the other star's hydrogen that it ignites a thermonuclear explosion. And there's the nova. Also, the Eta Aquarid meteor shower. Early May brings the annual Eta Aquarid meteor shower. These are meteors that originate from Comet Halley. Halley? Okay, it's H-A-L-L-E-Y, and you know, I've never been sure how to say that. I've always heard Halley's Comet, but maybe it's Halley. Anyway, Earth passes through the comet's dust stream each May, and again in October. Eta Aquarids are fast-moving, and a lot of them produce persistent dust trains that linger for seconds after the meteor's initial streak. This is one of the best annual showers in the southern hemisphere, but tends to be more subdued north of the equator, where we typically see 10 to 20 meteors per hour. On the peak night this year, the moon sets by around 3 in the morning, leaving dark skies until dawn for ideal viewing conditions. While the peak is early on the morning of May 6th, the two or three nights before that are also decent opportunities to spy a few shooting stars. May 6th, this week, is National Nurses Day. And it begins a whole week of celebrating nurses. And I have my friend Susan Connell here. She has a nursing background. And she is going to read a piece that she wrote about that whole tradition.
Oh, my goodness, Roxana. Can you imagine being cramped in a hospital within arm's length of another patient who is coughing or bleeding? On your body is the uniform you've worn for days. Patient gowns weren't a thing in 1853 during the Crimean War. Neither was sanitation. Lice crawl over your hair, your head itches. Rats bite at your toes and run over the dirty linen covering the unconscious patient on your other side. Sweat, pee, and poo assault your nose. The urine and stool are poured ever so carefully in buckets at the end of every bed. Covered, they are still attacked by flies. And the pain. The pain grips your gut, and you turn your head and vomit on the bed. Imagine Florence Nightingale rushing into the tight space between the beds, lifting your head to the pan in her hand. I personally can't imagine it or being in those conditions, because that nurse, Florence Nightingale, revolutionized health care from that day forward, implementing hand-washing protocols and sanitation, and slowed the death of soldiers. She advocated for fresh air, sunlight, and cleanliness. Clean water was a must at her hospital. Through the years of improvement and the adoption of evidence-based medicine, the nursing profession has emerged as number one in the most ethical and honest profession since Gallup started asking the question in 1976. Only 1 year, nursing was displaced, in 2001 by firefighters, understandably. In December of 2024, the last time the survey was done, other professions in the top five were grade school teachers, military officers, pharmacists, and medical doctors. In May, like you said, Roxana, hospitals celebrate Nurses Day in memory of Florence. It's her birthday, after all, and it's a time of honor, speeches, and parties. For 20 years, when I was the manager of the Family Birth Center at Bozeman Health, we celebrated big. We hung nurses' photos in the hallway with a pencil attached to a string and a little sign underneath that said, "Why I Love My Nurse Mary," or whatever her name was. Co-workers, patients, and docs were able to write their reasons. Number two, we compared nursing graduation photos of our nurses on bulletin boards with a photo of the nurse now. Number three, Patty Ford, a very generous massage therapist in town, brought in her table year after year and gave massages to nurses on their breaks during the whole week. She even came in for night shift. Number four, we had a flowing chocolate fountain with strawberries and other fruit. Number five, we posted thank you notes. Number six, we often had a table with nurses' caps, the caps nurses in our department wore while they were in nursing school. Nurses don't get caps any longer when they graduate, but in that day, every school had its own cap design to identify its own graduates. Some had ruffles, some had wings, some had points on the top. They were all very creative and different. Historically, caps came in vogue in the 1800s as a head covering for deaconesses, those who cared for patients. Originally, I thought probably caps were worn to protect nurses' hair from dirt and lice, but I couldn't verify that that was the case. The literature says they wore caps to identify that they were deaconess caregivers. I remember the day I got my cap before I entered the hospital doors as a student nurse. I proudly popped it above my bun. At graduation ceremony, 3 years later, after becoming a nurse, I attached a quarter-inch black velvet ribbon with KY jelly to the top of the wings to prove that I really was a graduate indeed. The KY jelly was effective until the next washing, when I removed it and then reattached it after it was pressed. This year, the National Nurses Day motto is, "Nurses make the difference." I'm sure your listeners, Roxana, like me, can remember one special nurse in their life who cared for them. As nurses, we also remember our peers who worked by our sides, those who are our wingmen day after day in difficult emergency situations.
Thank you, Susan. And I understand you've written a book. You want to tell us about that?
I would love to. Thank you. Like other nurses, I remember patients who made deep impressions on my heart, where in labor and delivery I saw birth and loss walk hand in hand. So I've written a book with honesty and humor and a deep sense of humanity and respect. The book is entitled Behind the Double Doors, Diary of a Montana Nurse. It's soon to be released by Ballantine Books, a subsidiary of Putnam Books, Random House Publishers. And I invite you to get one in a few months. Curl up in your favorite book nook and enjoy. Thank you, Roxana.
Well, thank you, Susan. And we're going to have Susan back next week doing a very special story for Mother's Day. And your daughter's interviewing you for this story, right?
Correct. Yes, she is.
Very cool. I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Right now, I am so appreciating the nurses in my life, and there have been many. Thanks again, Susan. Well, we have some local events coming up. KGBM is celebrating its 7th birthday with a jazz night on Saturday, May 9th. Doors open at 7 and music starts at 8. Suggested admission is $15 or whatever you can afford to give. There's also a 50-50 raffle. The location for KGVM's birthday party is the Gallatin Labor Temple at 422 East Mendenhall in Bozeman. And again, that is on May 9th. Doors open at 7 p.m. and music starts at 8 p.m. Pilgrim Congregational Church is having a rummage sale on Friday, May 9th from noon till 6 p.m. and Saturday, May 10th from 8 a.m. till 2 p.m. The last half hour on Saturday from 1 to 2 is a bag sale. The address is 2118 South 3rd Avenue, and that's one block south of Kagi on 3rd. The Gallatin Watershed Council on May 8th is doing Restoration Thursday, revegetation from 1 to 4:30 p.m. at Mandeville Creek in partnership with Trout Unlimited. This is a hands-on afternoon of revegetation work. You can help harvest and stake willows at a Trout Unlimited restoration site. Get your hands dirty, give back to nature, and be part of the effort to restore vital ecosystems. Also, on May 8th, it's Bozeman Dog Poop Cleanup from 4 to 6 p.m. in the greater Bozeman area. You can join us in cleaning our furry friends number 2 across the Lower Gallatin watershed before our favorite trails get busy and spring showers wash harmful nutrients into our rivers and streams. This event is hosted in partnership with Outside Kind and the Gallatin Valley Land Trust. Go to gallatinwatershedcouncil.org to sign up to help keep our watershed clean and healthy. Oh my gosh. I just saw the first glacier lily blooming in our backyard just now. Wow. That's so much to be thankful for right now. I also am thankful to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to all the volunteers and supporters of KGBM. Thank you, Susan Connell and science.nasa.gov. To Steve Grant and Kathy Katz for our nature readings from their books. And thank you for listening. Is there anyone you would like me to interview for a future show? You can leave a voicemail or text for me at 406-404-6246. You can hear this program broadcast on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. And, you know, all that talk about storytelling at campfires, it makes me think of Jack Johnson's song, Inaudible Memories. And that's from his album, Brushfire Fairy Tales. So, let's have that song take us out today. Jack Johnson's Inaudible Memories from Brushfire Fairy Tales. See you next week.
Dust off your thinking caps, solar powered plastic plants, pretty pictures of things we ate. We're only what we hate. But in the long run, we have found silent films are full of sound, inaudibly free. I wish they could believe in all the things and never made the screen and just slow down.